You are listening to Radio Maria Canada, a Catholic voice wherever you are. We now present the Catechism Hour, hosted by Brother Justin Bunyan.
Welcome to the Catechism Hour with me, Brother Justin Bonio, the Heralds of the Gospel. And we're going to look at the Third Council of Constantinople. But before diving into the council, I was going to go into where they went wrong. Particularly in the idea about it's the person of Christ. And what seemingly looks innocent has a lot of points to it that will cause a lot of consternation. So let's dive in. The doctrine of one will. Christ has but one will. This is known as monotheism. So this teaching that how the divine and human relate in the person of Jesus Christ. You may say, well, it's already been resolved with the problems that related to Arius. And then we had Nestorius, it's always an is at the end. This problem continues to push its head up. They say the father of all heresies is the devil himself, and the safeguard of all good virtues is God himself. The correct understanding is what God wants us to understand and God wants us to reach. So this problem on how the divine and human elements relate in the person of Jesus, this problem comes to a head in 629 in the schools and in the churches of Syria and Armenia. Now, if you look at a map today, and you look at Syria, and you look at Armenia, and you say, how can these two be related? Remember that Armenia was much larger then than it is now, and that its borders were on to Syria. And culturally speaking, throughout history, they've always had a lot of interaction. The Armenians were also very, very numerous in the plains of Cappadocia in what is Asia Minor. So just keep that in mind. It helps when we look at things and we look at a modern map and we say, I don't understand how these two are so important. So this particular heresy ends up finding its problem in the following. Jesus Christ has two natures, but one will. And this problem is contrary to many others that were the Orthodox positions, which was that though he has two wills, but he also has two natures. So this monotheism is a development post Chalcedon. Remember, Chalcedon was where Nestorius was condemned. And it becomes formulated in 638. And unfortunately, it enjoyed a tremendous amount of popularity and got support from the highest levels of the church in those areas. And that was before it was rejected and denounced as heretical in 681 in the Council of Constantinople. So let's go into a little bit of a background on it, understand where this comes from, why is it so complicated. During the 5th century, some of the areas of the Christian church were confused because of the debates that erupted about the nature of Jesus Christ. Remember, at that time, we didn't exactly have, well, even today, we don't have, our medias are sometimes inundated with fake news or fake information. But even then, at that time, it was even worse because there wasn't an easy ability to cross-check and to make sure something was true or false. You depended on word of mouth. So although the church had already determined that Christ is the Son of God, just what his exact nature was something that was constantly debated upon. The church had declared heretical the notion that Jesus is not fully divine. And that was the First Council of Nicaea in the 4th century. During its debates with Arianism, and had declared that he is God the Son, become man, incarnate by the Holy Spirit. However, in arguing that he is both God and man, it emerged a very grave, complex ideas and motions. And the problem was, what exactly is human and what exactly is divine? What exactly belonged to Christ? What belonged to Jesus? What was in the person of Christ? What's interesting is that today what we take is fruit of these discussions. This is why we must learn these things, because so that we don't end up having to go through the same difficulties that they did. Chalcedon gave definitions that Christ remains in two distinct natures, yet these two natures come together within one. More simply, Christ is known as both fully human and fully divine, one in being with the Father. And this position opposes a contrary position, which everybody loves to use. And it's funny, at this point, they use in English these Greek terms, which all sound very similar. You have the monocyte, monotheist, monotheisis. They're all the same idea. But the monotheisis held that Christ possessed one nature only. So it was neither, it was either human or divine. He had one nature. He didn't have two natures. He had one. And with that one, that was all you got. The figurehead of this motion, this heretical motion, was Euclesius. And he held that human and divine natures of Christ were fused into a single nature. So the human and divine kind of got melted into one. And his line was this, that Christ's human nature was dissolved like a drop of honey into the sea, and therefore the nature was truly and really divine. So the fusion of the natures left divinity as the greater one. And again, as one commentator put it, there must have been a lot of food around at this time, because there was lots of arguments lots of debates, lots of written work, but you don't see a lot of people working. The other group that opposed was called the Mia Pisces. And they held that after the union, Christ is one human divine nature and is generated from the union of the two natures. Also wrong, also messed up. But just to confuse everything, the two are thus united without separation, without confusion, without alteration, and each having particularness. Each one's different. And certain Oriental churches still hold aspects of this doctrine, particularly the Nestorian Church of the East, or known as the Assyrian Church of the East. So this caused a lot of stress. This caused a lot of debates between the two contrary groups and the teaching of Christ's humanity to be different than their own. So the Chalcedons accused others of espousing forms of Nestorianism that rejected the doctrine that Jesus held two distinct substances. This is sounds kind of pedantic, kind of complex. But if you understand, again, I call back to my own experience in a classroom, and when you bring these things up, you'll have children 12, 11 years old, and they look at you and they kind of twist their head. He goes, if he is only divine, he can't suffer. He's God. If he's only human, his suffering is no better than mine. Why couldn't they just get it? God can do all. And that's a product of hundreds of years of theology, hundreds of years of debates. And these people at that time didn't have that advantage. At the same time, we have another issue. The East was known that when they had debates, they tended to physically fight their way through it. It wasn't just a dry debate across the table. It was table throwing and plate throwing and knives and all kinds of great things. And this caused internal divisions for the Byzantine Empire, which was at this time under constant external stresses. Especially in areas most likely to be lost to the empire were the regions that favored these heretical positions. This puts the emperor in a very odd position, which is that if he opposes these heretical positions, he might just lose provinces of the empire. And they that lived in those areas considered the religious hierarchy in Constantinople to be heretics who were only interested in hurting them. Just to give you an example, in these provinces, the non-Chalcedonians were far more numerous than the Chalcedonians. In Egypt, for example, some 30,000 Greeks of Chalcedonian persuasion were ranged against by some 5 million Coptic non-Chalcedonians. Meanwhile, in Syria and Mesopotamia, where they divided between Nestorianism and Jacobinism, while the region of Armenia was wholly non-Chalcedonian. Consequently, the teachings emerged as a compromise position. They tried a compromise position to kind of find a means of unifying everything together. So the Byzantine emperor of Heraclius tried to unite everybody in the empire with a new formula that was inclusive and more elastic. whenever you try to do this, it adds just oil to the fire and you end up with just one more problem. This approach was needed to win over the non-Chalcedonians, but it didn't help, and it caused just more problems. So the first attempt at it was an interesting concept in which they changed the language, in which they called it the doctrine of one energy. The Patriarch of Constantinople was a driving force behind this doctrine with the full blessing of the emperor, who's trying to find a solution not to lose three quarters of his empire. So, what was it? It was a doctrine that was talked about in Armenia and many other places, that the energy or an active force of Christ was singular, the doctrine of monoangelism, and that idea about the idea that we change the terms and we just come up with some new novel terms. So instead of saying nature or substance, we're talking about energy. So they're trying to find a means, and they have a meeting with them, and this idea about this mono energy, this one, that Christ is but one energy. And he's able to win over five patriarchs, so Constantinople, Antioch, Alexandria, and the one theatric and theotonic energy. But then you have, now all you need is one to say the emperor has no clothes. And that is Sophrius. And he comes forward and says, this is unsound doctrine. And he becomes the champion of the doctrine of two wills of Christ. He's concerned that for the sake of ecclesiastical unity and doctrinal expressions are being compromised. For the first few years, Patriarch Sergius of Constantinople managed to keep him silent. But when this man is appointed the Patriarch of Jerusalem in 634, he uses his newfound position to challenge the validity of this energy idea. So the Patriarch of Constantinople, who has been able to kind of hold all the pots shut, writes to Pope Aronius I, and at 625-638 in Rome, and asks him to endorse the position that the church unity should not be endangered by having any discussions or disputes concerning Christ possessing one energy or two. Sergius added that the doctrine of the two energies could lead to the erroneous belief that Jesus has two conflicting wills. The Pope then replies in 635 and endorsed this view that all discussions should cease and agreed that Jesus does not have two conflicting wills, but one will, since Jesus did not assume a human nature tainted by Adam's fall, but human nature as it existed prior to Adam's fall. What happens is this, is that a lot of this is like that, the cup trick, in which you move the ball from one to the other, and as you spin them all around, you end up with tricks. This is the beginning of a process which the Italians, and I mean Italians in a very stretchy format, we Lombards still be... the clergy of Rome, let's put it that way, become more and more distrustful of anything Greek. Because a letter like this between one patriarch and another, the hope is that everyone is above board. when Rome finds out that someone is playing below board, then it gets complicated. Then I have a problem of trust. But in the meantime, the Patriarch of Jerusalem has a synod in Cyprus. In this attempt to show that the new doctrine is inconsistent with Orthodox teaching, he declared that it was nothing more than the other older heretical positions and therefore against the hard-fought achievements of Chalcedon. From there, suddenly the support of his doctrine subsided. No longer supporters could be found anywhere. And everyone started finding flaws and inconsistencies in the proposal. Very soon, even the sponsors of this project were looking at stopping, and they pulled the plug. So they moved to the next one, which was the doctrine of one will. And with the doctrine of one will, they moved towards a next level. They needed to find a solution, and anything that they could throw into the fire was worth it. So 3 years later, the Patriarch came up with a slightly modified formula, and the Emperor was more than happy to release it. The edict was considered to be an official response to the letter by the Patriarch of Jerusalem. It forbade all mention of Christ possessing one or two energies. Instead, it proclaimed that Christ, while possessing two natures, had but a single will. This approach seemed to be more acceptable compromise. And only once again, it secured widespread support throughout the East. The Patriarch of Jerusalem died while this new doctrine was being released. And his replacement, Bishop Sergius of Jaffa, as Patriarch, Abraham I of Jerusalem, approved the modified formula. And this moved things forward. Unfortunately, he did not count on the popes at Rome. Rome now is reading into what's going on. During the same period, Pope Irenaeus I died. His successor, Pope Severus, condemns it outright, and so was forbidden his seat until 640. His successor also rejects this doctrine completely and leads to a major schism between the east and western halves of the Chalcedon Church. When news reached Heraclius that of the Pope's condemnation, he was already old and ill. News only hastened his death, declaring that his dying breath, that the controversy was all due to Sergius, and that the Patriarch had pressured him to give his unwilling support to his doctrine. Trying to save part of his empire ends up being that it ends splitting the empire down the middle. And these conflicts continue to grow. So, but why? As some people might say, but it's not that important if one or two wills. But we fail to see that the whole doctrine of redemption is based on it. Our whole relation with Christ is based on it. Our whole understanding of Scripture is based on it. The modern day doctrines or devotions that we have. For example, we're coming in soon to the month of June and the month of the Sacred Heart. If there's some form of division in the person of Christ that could be possibly in conflict, then we adore his human, or do we adore his divine? Or is it a mishmash of the two? How does it work? It's important for us to understand these points because of that. And this is why these councils were so important, to get people face-to-face instead of by letter. Letter is nice, but letter doesn't work with tone. Italics can transmit maybe a point of sarcasm. So the state of schism is a terrible position for the church. And with that, the church prods ahead, as always. The emperor dies. Had thrown the political situation of Constantinople into chaos. And what's worse is that when you have a strong emperor and he dies and is succeeded by a grandson who is merely a boy, the political apparatuses tend to shrink and to break. Everyone vying for power, family members vying for power. And in the church of the 600s, we have clerics vying for power. Out from this, we have a great saint, which is known in the East as in the West. Maximus the Confessor from North Africa. And he attacks this limiting of the power and the person of Jesus in a ferocious manner. He convinces the African councils to draw up manifestos against this doctrine, and they are forwarded to the new pope, Theodore I, 642 to 649. Who in turn wrote to Patriarch Paul II of Constantinople. And we'll continue with this after we come back, but this is the turning point of the closure of the schism. Of course, when two people begin to speak, there's always a chance. We'll be back in a quick moment's time.
Amen.
Catechism Hour. Here on Radio Maria Canada, a Catholic voice, wherever you are. To contact us, you can tweet us at Radio Maria Can or email catechismhour@radiomaria.ca.
Welcome back. So the state of schism, the church racked in schism, is a terrible thing, a terrible event. So the new pope, supported by Maximus, the confessor, knowing that there is a level of support in the East for this position, writes to Paulus II and outlines why the doctrine is heretical, why it's wrong. Unfortunately, Paul replied in a letter directing the Pope to adhere to the doctrine of one will. Theodore in turn excommunicated the Patriarch in 649, declaring Paul a heretic. Unfortunately, this thing continues. Constance II is a young man of 17, and as most kids who are 17, he is incredibly indifferent to these debates. But he was concerned about the effect of all of these debates having on his empire. So he issues an imperial edict called the Type of Constance. So he made it illegal to discuss in any manner the topic of Christ possessing either one or two wills or one or two energies. He declared that the whole controversy was to be forgotten. Quote, the scheme which existed before the strife arose shall be maintained, as it would have been if no such disputation had arisen. Close quotes. He would soon discover that it's far too late to turn the clock back. A 17-year-old, she says, can't we all be friends? Just forget all this stuff. East and West were in opposition, but strong opposition, and it was becoming a fever pitch type relationship. This is where rhyme or reason doesn't work. And this edict didn't do anything to help anybody. Theodore planned a Lateran Council of 649 to condemn the doctrines, but died before he could convene it, which his successor, Martin I, did. Not only did the council condemn theses, but condemned the type as well. After the synod, Pope Martin wrote to Constance, informing the emperor of its conclusions and requiring him to condemn both the doctrine as well his own doctrine, his own document. Unfortunately, Constance was not the sort of emperor to take such a rebuke lightly. Even while the Lateran Synod was sitting, Olympius arrived as the new Etcharch in Ravenna. Etcharch was a type of archbishop in the north under the Greek auspices, with instructions to ensure that the type was followed in Italy, to be used whatever means necessary to ensure that the Pope adhered to it. He was unable to complete his mission and soon died, but his successor, Theodore I, seized Pope Martin and abducted him to Constantinople. Here he was imprisoned and tortured before being condemned for breaking the imperial commands and was banished for dying from his treatment at the hands of the emperor. The emperor continued to persecute anyone who spoke out against the monotheist doctrine, including Maximus the Confessor and a number of his disciples. Maximus lost his tongue and his right hand in the effort to have him recant. Nevertheless, this brutality did not have an effect, with patriarchs, including the popes, remained silent throughout the remainder of his reign. The last part here is very important. The Roman Emperor at Constantinople had enacted a persecution that would have made Diocletian happy. But unfortunately, the bishops and patriarchs this time, remaining silent was their way out. They went quiet. So the faithful perished. They were not shepherds. Shepherds would have died for their flock. With Constant's death in 668, the throne passed to his son, Constantine IV. The new pope, who had posted Constance in Rome, almost immediately declared himself in favor of the doctrine of two wills of Christ. In response, the patriarch Theodore I of Constantinople and Marcinius, patriarch of Antioch, both pressed Constantine to do some measure against this pope. Constantine, however, declared to let this question decide itself by a church council. He asked if the pope, at this stage, Pope Agero, would be willing to send delegates to an ecumenical council to be held in Constantinople to finally put an end to this question. The pope agreed and first held a plenary synod in 680 in order to obtain the opinion of the Western theologians. Other synods were held at Milan, the Council of Hatfield in 680, convoked by Theodore of Canterbury. All the Western synods condemned this doctrine, and the report to Rome's synod acts that were sent to Constantinople along with the Western delegates of the council. Council met in 680-681 apart from the Roman representatives. It was also hosted representatives from the Patriarch of Alexandria and Jerusalem, while the patriarchs of Constantinople and Antioch were present in person. It almost unanimously, with the exception of two individuals, condemned the doctrine as one that diminished the fullness of Christ's humanity and asserted that dialysism was the true doctrine, with Christ possessing two natural wills, two natural energies, without division, alteration, separation, or confusion. They also anathematized the chief representatives of the discredited doctrine, including Pope Irenaeus. The churches condemned at Constantinople included the Oriental Orthodox Church and the Maronite Church, including the Oriental Orthodox denied that they were ever held a monocide heresy at all. That's kind of comical. The moment that we all see that things are falling apart, the person distances themselves as though they had nothing to do with it. And the Maronites came to accept Chalcedon formula being in communion with the Roman Catholic Church. This brought the end of the controversy. The historian John Baglebury has an interesting point. And he said that the West, and mostly the Western clerics, generally disliked dialectics and also didn't fully understand all the details. So they look at the question of Pope Irenaeus supporting heretical positions, and you might ask the second question, which was, did he understand exactly what he was supporting, or was he just giving support to a fellow patriarch? The question that arose with Patriarch Sergius seemed to Irenaeus to be a matter of grammar rather than theology. Though he used the expression one will, he was no monocyte, for he placed one energy and two energies on exactly the same footing. Rather, in his second letter to Sergius, what he wrote was by large and truly orthodox. Maximus the Confessor, in his own work, interprets the statement of one will as referring to the integrity of Christ's human will, in contrast to the fallen will, which seeks diverse and contradictory goods. That puts us in a position where this council was important because it solved the problem insofar as Some of the other churches remained in their issue for time going forward, such as the Armenians. There was another element to look at it also, which wasn't so much the doctrine, but more the bird, the passenger bird that's flying by. It's kind of interesting where the politics cloud the religion. The Third Council of Constantinople posthumously anathematizes Arrhenius as a heretic. Quote, "And with these we define that there shall be expelled from the Holy Church of God and anathematize Arrhenius, who at some time Pope of Old Rome, because of what we found written by him to Sergius, that in all respects he followed his view and confirmed his impious doctrines, and to Arrhenius, heretic, anathema." However, Leo II's letter of confirmation of the council interprets the council as intending to criticize Arrhenius not for the error of his belief, but rather an imprudent economy of silence. Leo's letter states, "We anathematize the inventors of the new error. We anathematize the errors of the error, Theodore, Sergius, and also Arrhenius, who did not attempt to sanctify the apostolic church with their teachings, an apostolic tradition, but profane treachery permitted its purity to be polluted." You may say the greatest crime that this pope committed was that he didn't try to do better. He tried to find a middle position. Instead of educating himself on the points that were being brought forward, he found, as it says here, imprudent economy of silence. So with that, you end up with a situation where the church suffers because its shepherds don't do its job. And it allows these heresies to continue to grow and to continue to do evil. And with that evil, damages the very church of God that should be defended by these ones. It would not have made him popular, but certainly it wouldn't have him anathematized. He didn't see it happen to him during his life, but for his eternal memory, he has been turned into a byword. We have the obligation to pray for the leadership of the church. We have the obligation to pray for all those who have civil authorities. We also have a necessity to pray for those who are in positions of influence. Maybe this pope had weaknesses. Maybe he was ill-informed. Maybe he lacked support in the prayer life to make that tough decision. We don't know. We didn't live there. We don't live in his shoes. But it's interesting that in that sense, the church, through its multi-secular existence, has many a man that steps up, is known as being a hero and dies for it. Others that try to find a comfortable position and that are thrown down into history. We should pray in a special way for all those who are in positions like that. Pray every day for our pastors, for our bishops, for our priests, for our pope, that they do what is right, avoid what's wrong, but to speak out when difficult. Because that's the most difficult of it all. Many a times it's easier just to stay quiet. And by staying quiet, causes more issues. When we look at the councils and we understand where they come from and we understand where they're going, and we understand all these things, it helps us to have courage when we're called to be other Christs, particularly in a world that doesn't understand Christ, but more than that, in a world that not only doesn't understand, but is far from Christ. It might be when someone speaks at the table. It might be someone who speaks to us in a bus stop. It might be one who speaks to us in any which direction. It might be in any which direction that we go. It's up to us to make that right decision. In that right decision, in that right way, that we step and follow Christ, even if it means to walk the way of the cross. Christ's way of the cross wasn't easy. It was very difficult. And in being very difficult, it caused his death, death upon a cross. But it's up to us to carry our cross as well as he did. Christianos altum Christi. We're called to be other Christs. We look upon Christ's friends, the martyrs, the confessors, the doctors, the virgins, and we hope at one day to be one with them so that we can be one day with Christ in heaven, which is our homeland. These early church heroes were fighting for the element that we'd understand what it meant to be Christian. Some didn't follow. History speaks for itself. The areas which were inhabited with many of these Nestorians, these one will types in the East, will later become areas that become Muslim. The Donatists who fought Augustine when the Muslims come flipped to the Islamic religion. What is our position in all this? Do we take the easy way out? Or if we do, we get the reward that is due to us, which isn't great. When we look at the early church, many times when we are reading or teaching it, many people look at it saying, if I was there, I would be different. Public opinion never changes. And going against the flow is always difficult. The key is for us is to do what is right. There's your issue. No matter what time of the year, what year it is, what people are running around, it's always difficult. Always the mob doing something. Maximus the Confessor stood up for what was right. He gathered countless people to himself. He caused a revolution. He lost his hand, his tongue, and was tortured to death by another person who claimed to be Christian because he wouldn't stay quiet. And a pope was anathematized because he did stay quiet. What do we want for ourselves? It's up to us. So, with that said, hopefully you'll gather together with us next time. And we'll continue to look into some more doctrines. As we enter June, I'll be looking at the doctrine of the Sacred Heart of Jesus, understanding more about the historicity of the apparitions of our Most Sacred Lord to St. Margaret Mary Alacoque. And hopefully that will help us to grow in our devotion to the Sacred Heart. But as we get there, please keep us in your prayers. And I will also keep you in mind. May God bless you.
You've been listening to the Catechism Hour, hosted by Brother Justin Bonnion, here on Radio Maria Canada, a Catholic voice wherever you are.